This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 1st of March 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, it's been 3 months since the Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez was last seen in public. Has the race to replace him begun already? We're in Caracas. One country certainly going to the polls is Kenya. Voting takes place on Monday and there are fears that the result may, once again, spark violence. We meet an artist trying to prevent that happening.
Slowly we're winning the hearts and minds of the Kenyan people. And hopefully in another few years we can get the ballot revolution that you want.
Tyler and Andrew will also be here with a look back at the biggest news stories of the week. Plus, we'll be meeting one of our neighbours just down the road here from Midori House. And yes, music too. Don't worry. That's all to come on Midori House. So, rather a lot to fit into this Friday edition of Midori House. But first, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Political leaders in the United States are meeting for last-ditch talks to try to avoid huge spending cuts. Without agreement on a way to cut the budget deficit, cuts totaling $85 billion are due to come into effect at the end of the day. President Obama says it puts 750,000 jobs at risk and could have a huge impact on the U.S. economy.
None of this is necessary. It's happening because a choice that Republicans in Congress have made. They've allowed these cuts to happen because they refuse to budge on closing a single wasteful loophole to help reduce the deficit.
8 South African police officers have been suspended after a man was tied to the back of a van and dragged down a street. The taxi driver, originally from Mozambique, died in custody. Footage of the incident, captured on a mobile phone, has been broadcast around the world. Police say it revealed callous and unacceptable behaviour. Outside Davidson Police Station, crowds have gathered demanding action over the man's death.
The main duty of the police is to protect the people or the community, and even the taxi drivers also. That's still the community who must be protected by the police.
The suspension is issued next because they keep on doing the very same thing. It's not the first time, so they must make an example.
There have been violent protests in the Indian capital Delhi after reports that a 7-year-old girl has been sexually assaulted at a school. A number of teachers have been questioned over the alleged attack. Police broke up crowds who'd gathered at a hospital where the child is being treated. Meanwhile, Indian MPs have criticised the slow pace of investigations into the rape and murder of 3 young sisters aged between 6 and 11. No one has been arrested over the deaths last month. A Rwandan-born Dutch citizen has been jailed for inciting genocide. Yvonne Basebia encouraged attacks on her Tutsi neighbours before the Rwandan genocide of 1994, in which 800,000 people died. 4 years later, she moved to the Netherlands. Basebia was jailed for 6 years and 8 months. Kenya's president has appealed to the country for a peaceful election. 8 candidates are standing to be Mwai Kibaki's successor. He says it's essential that the election send a message to the world about Kenya's progress.
Peace is a cornerstone of our development. As a country, we must consolidate the development strides we have made by ensuring a free, fair, just and peaceful elections.
Italy's president has ruled out an early election after the inconclusive results of last week's vote. Giorgio Napolitano says Italy needs a stable government. Pierluigi Bersani, whose Democratic Party won the largest share of the vote, has ruled out a grand coalition with Silvio Berlusconi's centre-right group. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. It's 18:04 here in London, 13:04 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield and you're listening to Midori House. has the race to become the next president of Venezuela begun already? It is now 3 months since Hugo Chavez was last seen in public, aside from the occasional image of him smiling from a hospital bed. Today, his vice president and preferred successor, Nicolas Maduro, has been on television reminding Venezuelans that Chavez is, in his words, fighting a great battle for his life, for his health. Maduro himself is also fighting a battle of sorts. If Chavez, as many people suspect, is not able to resume his presidency, Maduro, a former bus driver turned Chavista, will have to face the electorate himself. Irene Caselli is Monocle 24's new Caracas contributor, and she joins me now from the Venezuelan capital. Irene, there's been a lot of pushback from Chavez's people today saying, okay, he's fighting for his life, but he's not dead yet. How has everything sort of built up to this climax over the past few days?
Well, there's a lot of rumors for sure here in the country. At the same time, people are sort of waiting and watching to see what's happening. They're waiting to see whether Chavez will come back. Actually, a poll that was released yesterday said that 58% of Venezuelans think that Chavez is still alive and he'll... And he's getting better, and there's a chance that he's going to get better. So there's definitely a sense here of expectation. At the same time, this cannot be denied. A lot of people are also waiting to see what will happen next politically. Maduro has been in charge for the past 3 months since Chavez went to Cuba for his last operation. And obviously he's been acting as president, but if any announcement were to be made about Chavez, then new elections would be called. And so there's already a sort of run-up to an election in a very informal way, as you were saying. Opposition candidates are, several opposition parties are looking for a candidate. Maduro is positioning himself.
We're in a strange sort of limbo in a way, because obviously officially there's no election and no one really wants to start out and out electioneering, because it's it just doesn't really seem right while Chavez is still alive. But as you say, the opposition is already starting to make noises. Last time around they had Enrique Capriles. Is it likely that he's going to run again, or are new names being mentioned?
Well, a lot of people are pitching in. There's 30 parties that make up the opposition. So obviously there's a lot of, there's been a lot of infighting, let's say. Most opposition members of the opposition are very vocal about this. To be fair, Capriles seems to be the only one who has enough popular support. In another poll, 70% of people said that they recognize Capriles as the only person who could actually run a successful campaign for the opposition. And just this week, during a visit to a school, he actually said, you know, I've already won against two vice presidents. If someone else wants to come at me, then they can, but I'm a strong person. I'm a strong political candidate. So as you say, you know, nobody is really talking about a campaign yet, but yet most people are wondering what's next for the country.
Now, obviously, you know, Chavismo and the Bolivarian Revolution is all completely wrapped up in the personality of one man. Is there a sort of a private understanding amongst leading figures within Chavez's group that that things can't necessarily go on like this forever? That at some stage they have to make a decision that either they call an election, they say, you know, he's not fit to carry on, or he needs to reappear.
Well, I think that everyone is very cautious. What's clear is that for now, Maduro is the person in charge. Chavez named him as his preferred successor before he went to Cuba for his last operation, the last time that he actually talked in public. So there is definitely a sense that timing is going to be very important. Let's not forget that once an official announcement is made, according to law, the elections need to take place within 30 days. So obviously there's not going to be much time for a campaign, and I am sure this is very much on the mind of the government as well.
Irene Caselli in Caracas, thank you very much indeed. And that's not the first time we've covered Venezuela this week on Midori House. On Monday's show, we spoke to Rory Carroll, author of a new book, Comandante, which is all about Hugo Chavez. And one of the questions I asked him, which I think is relevant to replay now, was what it's like to cover Chavez as a journalist in Caracas.
It was fascinating as a journalistic enterprise. A lot of it, though, would entail watching television, because he was almost always on TV, and this would be live, and amazing things would happen while he was on TV. He could mobilize troops to the Colombian border. He could nationalize an industry. You just never knew quite what happened.
A very strange form of transparency.
Yes, it was basically ruled by television, which is why I was quite keen to get on his show or to see it firsthand. And I did one time. And that was just amazing, just to see the show and then suddenly to become part of it, because he ended up using me as a prop, if you like, on his show. And that was his way. You know, he would just look for opportunities to create diversions and create a circus in a way. And I mean, I had my own role as an animal in his Colosseum.
Did you find that quite difficult?
Well, I found it. Yeah, I guess I did. I found it was fascinating. I mean, he invited me to ask a question on his show as a "Hola, Rory Carroll del Guardian." You know, tell us, what is your question? So I asked him a question about basically why he was centralizing power in the presidency, and he loathed the question. He hated it, and so he basically poured a bucket of rhetorical excrement over my head for it went on for ages, or maybe 30 minutes or so.
Question you've got to ask, though.
It was, because there was a particular moment in time why I had to, that was the question to ask. But the interesting thing is, I mean, he used me in a way as a punching bag for his show, and it made for good television, because it was, you know, I was then the villain, the stand-in villain. But at the end of the show, when it ended, he shook my hand, he was perfectly civil, and, you know, and he was fine. And it was understood that really this was just a show and I had my role in it.
That was Rory Carroll talking to me there, and you can hear that whole interview on Monday's Midori House. Just go to monocle.com, or of course you can download it via iTunes. And don't forget that Rory's book, which I do heartily recommend, is called Comandante and is out next week. Up next, we cross to Kenya just days ahead of the presidential election.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental, it does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider, because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's a review every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Elections take place in Kenya on Monday and everyone is nervous. More than 1,000 people lost their lives in the wake of the last poll in violence that was as planned as it was deadly. Many senior members of Kenya's elite were accused of orchestrating the killings, and six of them faced trial at the International Criminal Court, including, worryingly, one of the current candidates for president. Kenya's tensions go back over decades, a toxic mix of arguments over wealth, power, land and ethnicity. In a moment, we'll speak to our Nairobi correspondent, Tristan McConnell. But first, James Reynolds spoke to Boniface Mwangi, a photographer whose coverage of the aftermath of the last election won numerous awards. This time around, Mwangi has tried to use his art to challenge some of the underlying problems in Kenyan society.
Hundreds of protesters paraded outside Kenya's parliament earlier this year, carrying black wooden coffins that were piled up and set ablaze. The message was simple: lawmakers are ripping off the public and need to be taught a lesson. The man behind the protest was Kenya's conceptual artist, Boniface Mwangi, and for him, it's no laughing matter.
My work, I don't want to make you laugh. That's not my idea. I want to upset you. I want to make you so mad. That's why we call people idiots. We want to upset you and provoke you to think. Because there's a lack of thought in this country. People don't think. They just vote without thinking.
Mwangi relays his political message through several media. Publicity stunts like the parliamentary protest, photographs and hard-hitting graffiti across the bustling capital, Nairobi. For this, he's been compared to the British street artist Banksy.
Banksy is good as well because Banksy is very provocative. Banksy is like showing the finger to the system, and he does it very well. I even thought he could do a Banksy style when he went anonymous, but in a small city with very few graffiti artists, it's not so easy to do that.
While Banksy is famous for rats and riot police, Mwangi's central image is the vulture. In his iconography, the vulture is a politician and tribal leader who steals taxes and lands with impunity. And it's timely. On Monday, Kenyans will vote for their next president. The frontrunners, Uhuru Kenyatta and Raila Odinga, come from two of the country's biggest ethnic groups. But it's not just the vulture-like politicians that Mwangi is aiming at.
Actually, it's both the politician and the Kenyan voter. If you look at the main frontrunners, that's Uhuru Kenyatta and Raila Odinga, both of them are tribal kingpins. Uhuru has been accused of crimes against humanity, so he's almost culpable of that. You look at Raila Odinga, has been accused of corruption, so it's not far from the truth. And the sad truth is that they are voted by idiots, which is me and many other Kenyans who vote for them. We have rapists, murderers, land grabbers and looters in power, and we, the idiots, vote for them.
While Kenyans have more political freedom than they did a decade ago, Mwangi says he's still hassled by police. His graffiti gang members, the Spray Uzi as they are known, have put down their paint cans ahead of a potentially volatile election season.
It's selective application of the law because you have many graffitis in this city, present politicians, no one is touching them. So they arrest me to intimidate me. But when they realized that wasn't working, they said, well, every time we do a graffiti, they come with a fresh coat of paints and just paint it. So we're very effective in the work that we're doing, and that's why we've been arrested. I think their response is to, they have realized that the message is reaching the masses. We've been able to change the language of the country. So when you talk about a politician, you don't say politician, you say vulture. Slowly we're winning the hearts and minds of the Kenyan people. And hopefully in another few years, we can get the ballot revolution that you want.
To understand Mwangi's dedication, one need only look back to the violence that followed Kenya's last election in 2007. Wrangling over who had won led to a brutal wave of inter-tribal violence that claimed more than 1,100 lives. During that period, Mwangi captured the bloodshed and mayhem in a much-praised collection of photographs.
As a newspaper photographer, I always wanted to cover conflict, so it was like I was able to cover conflict at my own doorstep. I would just open the door and the people being killed.
His work has been showcased in downtown Nairobi in the run-up to the upcoming vote on March the 4th. Organisers say the gruesome images will make Kenyans think twice before picking up their machetes again. For Mwangi, the message is simple.
Why are we tribal? That's the biggest question. You meet Kenyans, they're very cheerful, they smile, they laugh, they talk about how nice the weather is, and how they're going to hang out and how they are living good and tweeting and all these things, but they never talk about tribalism. It's not spoken about, but when I meet you, I want to know your second name so that I can put you in a place and know, oh, you come from this province, come from that province. And it's a problem. It's a big problem. So eventually you have to address the tribe issue or we perish.
And during this election season, it will become clear whether Mwangi's message has hit home. For Monocle in Nairobi, I'm James Reinel.
And we cross back to Nairobi now, where our correspondent Tristan McConnell is standing by. Tristan, you've been covering the final days of this campaign. The two main candidates are Raila Odinga and Uhuru Kenyatta. When given everything that happened last time, how careful have the preparations been for this year's election?
Well, I think people have been much more focused on the way in which politicians have been running their campaigns. So there are new laws against things like hate speech, and that was a major factor in kind of setting the scene for the kind of violence that followed the close elections last time around. And there have also been a few reforms in Kenya which help to give people a bit more confidence this time around. So the new Chief Justice and the judiciary has been reformed, and that means that a lot of the candidates are already saying that if they dispute the results, they will be happy to go to court rather than, you know, send the folks onto the street, and that will be a major improvement and certainly makes it more likely that we'll have a peaceful election. And there's also a new Electoral Commission, and that's significant because really it was the Electoral Commission that you know, messed up the results and handed the victory to the current serving president, Mwai Kibaki, when it was very much unclear that he'd actually won. So the change to the Electoral Commission, the improved judiciary, and the new laws on hate speech are setting the scene for what one hopes will be a much more peaceful election. But that said, you know, if you look at the more local level political campaigning, which is often done in the vernacular, in small villages and so forth, and we are hearing the kind of things, you know, sort of kick out this tribe or kick out that tribe, or, you know, if they steal our election, we'll show them who we really are. And those kind of comments are very worrying in the Kenyan context.
And now, I mentioned earlier that several people faced trial at the International Criminal Court. That trial, I mean, it was supposed to be next month, but it looks like it's going to be put back even further now. And, you know, the fact remains that that no one's been held accountable for what happened last time. So given that, do you think that people realise that if they do commit acts of violence in the name of an election, that they can get away with it still?
Certainly the impunity, which has been one of the, you mentioned at the beginning, the various things that make Kenyan elections so kind of dangerous, and impunity is one of them. And while, as you say, you know, no one has been brought to account for really any of the killings or any of the chaos that followed the last election, the fact that the ICC indictments have been made, the fact that, you know, one of the presidential candidates and his running mate are both going to go to court, albeit more likely in August now rather than April, but, you know, they're not wriggling out of this, at least not at this stage. And so I think that has sort of made it clear that you will have to answer, at least the big fish, if you like, will have to answer. At the lower level, I think there is a lot of concern. I know I've been traveling around Kenya for the last couple of weeks, up the Rift Valley, down to the coast and other places, trying to get a sense of what's going on. And, you know, there is definitely a sense that the kind of, if we're going to see violence this time around, it's more likely to be sort of localized and quite scattered. There's a new constitution in Kenya which is supposed to devolve power to a whole bunch of new counties, 47 of them. And what that's doing is devolving the political fight. So, you know, in 2007 and 2008, it was a widespread battle over the presidency. This time, as one person said to me the other day, we've got 47 presidents and 47 battles for those presidencies. So I think we're going to see smaller scale violence in widespread location, which will be sort of quite quickly nipped in the bud. At least one hopes that'll be the case.
Now, most of the talk, not just internationally, but in Kenya itself, surrounding the election, has been about those efforts to ensure that it remains peaceful, that we don't see the violence that we saw last time. Have there been any opportunities for actual proper debate over, you know, actual issues, which frankly in Kenyan elections in the past have been few and far between?
No, not really, no. I mean, we've had, look, there was a major breakthrough with this election, was that we actually had a couple of live presidential debates. And, you know, 10, 15, 20, 50 years ago in Kenya, it was unthinkable that, you know, you would have the leading contenders for a presidential vote in a room together, being forced to answer questions live on television, and, you know, squirming and finding it difficult, stumbling over their words, and really being faced with some pretty tough questioning from the moderators, and that was very impressive, and I think that opened people's eyes a lot. It made these candidates look, in some cases, silly, in other cases, fallible, in other cases, you know, impressive. But that aside, there really has been very little room for proper discussions of policy, and that's partly because many of the policies all that the same. They're all kind of saying the same things, and a lot of it, you know, is fairly pie in the sky, if we're honest about the state of the economy and the ability of, you know, the next government to actually deliver on these election promises. So, you know, it's certainly still the case that this election is more about people voting in tribal blocs than it is about, you know, people voting on policy lines. And I think, you know, something Boniface said in that interview we heard just before, he often talks about this thing he wants to call a ballot revolution. Mm. And in that clip you said, you know, we're a few years from that. And I think he's right. This is not going to be the watershed election where everything changes for Kenyan politics. But it could be the election, at least many people hope, but it could be the election that kind of puts to rest the ghosts of the 2007-2008 election.
Tristan McConnell, we certainly hope so. Thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. And you can hear Tristan's thoughts on Election Day on The Globalist when he joins Tyler and Emma Nelson on Monday morning. Now, 4 years ago, the Kenyan trio Just a Band produced one of the best albums to come out of East Africa in a good 30 years or so. It was called 82. They released a new album last year called Sorry for the Delay. And this is, in my opinion, the best song on it. It's Probably for Lovers. Probably for Lovers there by Just a Band from their album Sorry for the Delay. In the next half hour here on Midori House, I'll be joined by Andrew Tuck and Tyler Brulé to discuss the week that was in news. We'll meet our antique neighbours. I'm talking about a shop, obviously, not people. And we'll also muse on why British transport just isn't quite what it should be.
This race to the bottom in transport means people's expectations have been ground right down. A friendly cab driver or a tasty breakfast is now an unexpected surprise. And when it comes to what happens on board, well, anything short of a derailment is bliss.
That's Emma Nelson. You can hear more from her later. But first, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
Last-ditch talks to try to avoid huge spending cuts in the United States have broken up without agreement. It means that cuts totaling $85 billion are still due to come into effect at the end of the day. President Obama has said if that happens, it will put 750,000 jobs at risk. 8 South African police officers have been suspended after a man was tied to the back of a van and dragged down a street. The taxi driver, originally from Mozambique, died in custody. After footage of the incident captured on a mobile phone was broadcast around the world, police have said it revealed callous and unacceptable behaviour. There have been violent protests in the Indian capital Delhi after reports that a 7-year-old girl has been sexually assaulted at a school there. Police earlier broke up a large crowd who'd gathered at the hospital where the child's being treated. Kenya's president has appealed to the country for a peaceful election. 8 candidates are standing to succeed Mwai Kibaki. More than 1,000 people died in violence surrounding the last election in 2007. And in Italy, the country's president has ruled out an early second election after the inconclusive results of last week's vote. Giorgio Napolitano says that Italy needs a stable government. But Pierluigi Bersani, whose Democratic Party won the largest share of the vote last weekend, has ruled out forming a so-called Grand Coalition with Silvio Berlusconi's centre-right group. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Paul, thank you very much. It is 20:33 in Tallinn, 18:33 here in London, and 10:33 a.m. in Vancouver. Everywhere, though, it is Friday. At least I think it's everywhere still Friday.
No, I don't think so. No, it's maybe not Friday in Asia.
No,
anymore.
Okay. Or at least they might still have that Friday feeling,
they might
though.
Do.
I certainly
they
hope so. That voice you hear is Tyler Brulé. I'm also joined by Andrew Tuck. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
Now, because it's Friday, we thought we'd get you round the table for the week in review, but also, frankly, because it's a Midori House I'm presenting, it seems like you two are always here as guests. But I'm fine with that. We're going to look back at the week that was. Andrew, what happened?
Well, let's go day by day, hour hour by hour.
Why don't you start? Well, actually, we should probably pick up on a story that Paul just had. Maybe at the beginning of the week, there was the news that a comedian had kind of stolen the scene in Italy in the elections. Beppe Grillo, of course, taking a large amount of the votes in Italy and causing a kind of even more of a kind of a stalemate than usual. And It's just terrifying when you look at poor Italy that they are torn between all these warring parties, and here's Beppe Grillo has all this power now, and he doesn't want to use it, and he doesn't want to make any alliances with anyone, and it does mean that, you know, they won't get through the austerity measures. There's a real question mark against brand Italy, I think.
I'm also surprised there hasn't been more discussion though about Beppe Grillo's hair. There's a real issue, but I think, and oddly, it is the hair of the Italian aristocrat. Someone could spend a lot of time on this particular hairdo, because you go to a number of fashion shows. Even Andrew, we were at a pub last night, and you also spotted a woman with a similar hairdo as well. It is a Beppe Grillo, and you actually thought that she was Italian. In fact,
someone we know in Milan, and she looked very like her from the back.
Really?
Very frizzy hair. A lot of backcombing going on.
I think you both look nice with the Grillo.
We'll see about that. It is interesting, though, how it's almost like he hadn't really thought what came next after he did, he obviously hoped he'd do quite well in the election, but then didn't think, you know, who could I possibly go into coalition with, or if I choose not to, what happens then?
Well, I think there might be a really good story there. You know, the men and women, probably men, though, behind Beppe Grillo. You wonder what that machine and the whole apparatus looks like. I would love to see an organisational chart behind him.
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing who their MPs actually are, because most of them have never been involved in politics before. And it's interesting, you see this rise of the fringe party. We've seen it here in the UK, Andrew, today. We had a by-election and the UK Independence Party came second. You're seeing this sort of rise of this anti-politics parties across Europe.
Yeah, these protest votes. And I think you see the same, you've seen the same in Sweden and in Germany. You know, and they get, you know, good votes behind them. But then, as you say, what happens next? And that's the problem even for that UKIP here. They're a one kind of track party, I think.
Mm. Let's stay in Italy when it comes to news that's happened this week. Or sort of technically not Italy, because it is its own country. Yeah, the Vatican. We bade a fond farewell. A fond farewell, was it, maybe?
I think it was surprisingly fond, because I think for someone who was seen as a slightly chilly Pope by many, and maybe not the leader that everyone thought they were going to get, after John Paul, you know, here we had a man who was able to fill the Vatican, you know, 80,000 people. You know, when we saw him, arrive yesterday, very nice helicopter, by the way.
I was just going to talk to you about the helicopter. Do you think that's a bit jarring for the Pope to be in a helicopter?
No, I think not. I think
a bit nearer to God. Just that bit.
That is what
it was on all the channels as well.
The helicopter run was
Al Jazeera, Sky, France 24.
And there's a couple of interesting things that come from that, because you're talking about sort of dysfunctional brand Italy. Here you saw this, you know, brand new, you know, reasonably freshly minted, Augusta helicopter, so a great representation of Italian engineering and know-how, with Repubblica Italiana on the side of it. It looked rather impressive. I even thought Rai did a great job, because they obviously had to have another helicopter above that helicopter to then show him flying to the papal retreat, etc. There was something incredibly regal about it.
I think they had more than one as well.
There were a lot of helicopters flying around.
No, exactly. So I think that there was something, you think, God, I wish this country could get its shit together.
Yes.
I'm not talking about the Vatican. Well, them too.
But well, the Vatican has different sort of shit to get.
They do.
Now, I don't want to make things too serious, but another story that was touched on there in the news, which again is this taxi driver story from South Africa. I wonder with the Oscar Pistorius story and this, if you were sitting in the kind of the South African tourism department, what you must think for your brand and your nation brand. We talk a lot about nation brand. It must be the toughest time ever for South Africa, don't you think?
Well, not to mention, I just got an email about an hour ago from the South African Tourism Board inviting me. They were chasing me to come to this breakfast to taste the delights of South Africa.
Don't let them send a car for you. Sorry.
But it is, you know, you can spend all the money you want on hosting, you know, Football World Cup and put on a great show.
Yes.
You can wheel out Nelson Mandela for as many adverts as you want and show. It's amazing scenery. And it is. It's, you know,
you can bring Desmond Tutu as well if
you
want.
It's beautiful. But then all it needs is a shaky video on a mobile phone of, you know, your police officers acting like that.
But it does fit together with the Oscar Pistorius story because it is about security in that country. And, you know, his story kind of stands up a little bit more in South Africa, perhaps, than outside, because you have this belief that actually everyone does surround their buildings with high walls and electric fences and has security guards and is nervous.
Well, it goes
and people react slightly crazily.
It goes back to the issue of, you know, branding a country. You can't brand a country if the country doesn't have much to brand in the first place. And South Africa has a real trouble with violence and real trouble with a corrupt and violent police force, which we've seen. One leader departed, another leader came in South Korea.
Yes, goodbye to Lee Myung-bak and hello to President Park, another President Park, Park Geun-hye, who had an inauguration on Monday. And quite a remarkable story to watch, that here you have, of course, one of the most respected economies in the region, and then female leadership suddenly. But one of the things I really loved about this story was, you know, the Koreans have, you know, widely been accused quite often of being perhaps, you know, some of the best copycats of the late 20th and 21st, and certainly early 21st century. And here she put on an inauguration show, which was very U.S. presidential. So she didn't have Beyonce lip syncing. She had Psy, of course, doing that number that he does.
But I don't know that one.
No. I wonder if we have a clip. But what was also fascinating about the story, though, was something I picked up in the Chosun Ilbo today. She has commissioned a car which is not unlike the Beast. And, of course, the Beast being Barack Obama's armored vehicle. She has the Hyundai Equis version, which was completely armored by a firm in Germany. So it's amazing how Seoul and the Blue House, maybe the Blue House will become the White House, you never know, that they're taking on all of these Washington-style trappings.
And you'll be able to see more about the Hyundai Equis.
Equis,
is that what we call it?
Equis.
Okay. In the May issue. Obviously, I've commissioned stuff already,
Andrew.
That'll be the motorcade in the May issue. Quick before we go, the April issue that we're finishing tonight.
Correct.
Are we good?
Almost good. I think I may be seeing you for breakfast tomorrow. Don't mean I'll be coming home with you. Don't worry. But I think we may be in here tomorrow.
I think we will be. There's one or two things which I want to give a little bit more attention to, but a very, very exciting issue of cover that we've cracked. And it's looking handsome.
Yes, very handsome. It's picking up on our style directory, and which is a kind of more serious bent than most people's style directory. It's, we're kind of looking at the world of retail in the future, and also everything from like how the mall can save a city to actually why the Swiss investing in watches is good for their brand.
And you'll be able to read all that in about 3 weeks' time. Just under three
Indeed.
Weeks. But don't forget the German issue is out right now.
Have a nice weekend, Steve.
That. Thank you.
See you tomorrow.
I'll see you upstairs in about 20
minutes.
Yeah, in
about 20 minutes.
Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck, thank you very much. Still to come on Midori House, we'll meet some neighbours and we'll find out what could be the final chapter for The Nook. Don't go away.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
You can be European, meaning reliable, responsible, you believe in democracy and environmental protection and, you know, equal justice. These are all Islamic values too.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
It's not like New York, because New York, it's like you can walk to Central Park, you can walk anywhere you want. There's an urban continuity. In here, you have to get into a car or get into something that moves and get out of here.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo?
striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job. Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week, we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes audacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nous by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world, The Entrepreneurs is a living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And you're back with Midori House, 1943 in Stockholm and Vienna, 1843 right here in London. In a moment, we'll be hearing about the perils of the e-reader business. But taking us there is an artist who got everyone talking at the recent Bilam Music Conference in Oslo. This is Myrrh. That was Glass, the latest single from Norwegian artist Myrrh, which is out now. Myrrh, if you want to know how it's spelt, is M and O, O with a, you know, one of those lines through. Myrrh. There we are. You're listening to Midori House. Right, time to talk about publishing. The launch of Amazon's Kindle e-reader in 2007 sent shockwaves through the publishing industry. 2 years later, America's biggest seller of books, Barnes & Noble, brought out its own e-reader, the Nook, and it's been playing catch-up with Amazon ever since. But it hasn't been playing catch-up very well. Recent figures show that the Nook e-book business is nosediving at a catastrophic rate, and tellingly, far faster than Barnes & Noble's traditional bricks and mortar and ink and paper businesses. So, was this all a huge mistake? Monocle's Clemency Burton-Hill put this question to writer and journalist Mark Mason.
I think this is a blip, and I think I know why. We're in a very curious, very specific, unique phase of the e-reader, because they're very, very common now. People have had them for so long. And the really unique point we're at now is that I think a lot of people who grew up, people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, who grew up with conventional books, have now got one of these e-readers, and they're constantly going on the store going, oh, there's that, I want to read that, I want to read that, I want to read that. They've ended up with like 200, 300, 400 books on their e-reader waiting to read. Now, in the old days, if you had 200, 300, 400 books waiting by your bed on your bedside table to read, you'd notice it.
Tell me about it. I struggle with that guilt every day of my life.
You know what? In fact, I'm looking at mine now. I'm looking at the stack. I'm standing by my bed now, and my rule is when the stack gets, and I stack them horizontally, when it gets to higher than the mattress, I'm not allowed to buy any more.
See, I have the same, but like when it's higher than my head, because if it was a mattress, I'd be in real trouble.
But we're used to that because we've grown up and we value books as something really, you know, we value it intellectually. We hate the idea of buying a book that we're not going to read. Yep. And we hate that idea of wastage of just, oh, there's no way I can ever read these 200 books. So I think people are getting a little bit disenchanted with their e-readers for that reason.
Let's talk about the actual Nook as a device. I mean, many people were saying earlier this year that just as the e-reader revolution seemed to be beginning, it was almost over, partly because of competition not just from things like Kindles, but from iPads and from other devices.
You see more and more people reading books on their iPhone now. And as phones get that little bit bigger, which a lot of people are having, like the new Samsung that's a bit bigger, as people get phones that are bigger and they're slightly further towards the size of a page of a conventional book, I think more and more people will do that. And I think we'll end up with you just have one tablet device in your pocket that is your phone, your camera, the thing you read your books on.
Looking at the sort of context of the e-reading wars, if you look at the last couple of years, of course, you know, the big, big lawsuits, the publishers versus Apple and the price fixing and all the rest of it. You know, one of the problems was that people were accusing Amazon of, you know, making a massive loss so that they could sell books for $9.99 a piece when the publishers had sold them to them for $15 a piece, and then people are thinking, well, hang on, why am I even spending $10 on a big hardback? You know, I should be able to get this for 79 cents or 99p or something.
I think a huge part of it, the whole reason that publishers could be in trouble is the same reason that record companies no longer exist, is that you're cutting out the middleman. Yeah. And that's where a huge amount of the money is. You know, off a $10.99 book, whichever store it is, Waterstones or W.H. Smith or Barnes & Noble or whoever it is, they get their cut. You know, the printer who actually physically prints the thing has to get their cut. You know, all those middlemen.
To say nothing of the author who's probably spent 10 years of their life sweating over that book.
Well, I wasn't going to mention the poor author because I didn't want people to think I wanted them to get their small violins out for me.
That was Mark Mason and his small violin speaking to Monocle's Clemency Burton Hill. You're with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, and it's that time of the week here on a Friday evening where we take a stroll around Marylebone to meet the neighbours. And today we visit Claude Gallery, a rather quaint little antique store on Chiltern Street. It's a shop with a rich history, and Monocle's Ben Jay dusted off the cobwebs and went down there to find out how the shop has lasted for longer than some of its antiques.
My name is Claude Kearley and we're based at 16 Chiltern Street and the shop's name is Claude Gallery. We've been situated in Marylebone since, 1972, which coming up, 40 years in this street. And my father started the business and we were in George Street before the building was demolished, and he started that in 1948. There was something upwards of 50 antique shops around me when I first moved into Chiltern Street. Unfortunately, most of them, or all of them, have gone, apart from the upmarket ones, which are in Bond Street. I think the trick has been that I've always concentrated on selling retail, and all my furniture is in restored condition and ready to go, and that I feel that my prices are very fair, as against not saying other dealers were unfair, but they concentrated a lot on selling amongst themselves, which when you get a dip in the market, that's the first area really to suffer big time. Just recently we had what's called an artist table, which had a ratchet system where the centre lifted up and it had two side flaps at a price which really wasn't a great deal of money. It was, I think it was just around about the £700 mark, and that sold within a few days, although I thought it might stick because how many people are looking to do a bit of artwork? But there again, we got somebody who does artwork at home and said it was the perfect item. 0207. I don't approve of the television programmes which you see where the items are asking price is £200 and all of a sudden they've got it for £25. That's just not in the real world. I mean, I tend to price according to what I feel I would be happy in paying myself without going over the top. Sometimes we do actually run things out at a loss because the cost of restoring has gone, tipped it over the point I feel happy with. Well, yes, the antique trade generally for furniture like I'm selling at any price has really suffered. Me particularly, I've suffered because of the congestion charge. My turnover dropped by 50% almost overnight once the congestion charge came in. It was always there, pushing, you know, anything between £10 and £60 onto an item, depending on how much movement it needed within the congestion zone, restorers, upholsterers, etc., etc. Now people are telling me things have turned, and yes, we've sold a lot more in the last couple of months than we had done the previous year. I suppose 3 years ago was really the pits for the antique trade. We can get a Lord or we can get the road sweeper. We're that diverse, and you know, you might find that a strange statement, but we have sold to both. Some of it comes from word of mouth, from people that have purchased from me or seen something in somebody else's property and said, oh, where did you get that? How much did you pay, etc.? I hate saying it, but we've never advertised in the 60 years plus that my father started the business. We've never advertised once.
That was Claude Kearley from Claude Gallery, just around the corner from us here at Midori House. Nearly at the end of the show, but don't worry, still time to squeeze in our little comment piece for the day. In today's monologue, we turn to Monocle 24 presenter Emma Nelson, who's been listening with interest, as I'm sure you all have, to this week's series on Monocle 24, exploring high-speed rail. And she's been wondering why Britain has struggled to keep its own vision for this kind of service on the rails.
Last weekend, I took a journey that began perfectly. My taxi driver was smiling and courteous and took the speediest route. The railway station was modern. Its recent restoration paid tribute to its glorious heritage, and there were no pigeons fouling the coffee shop sofas. My breakfast, porridge, tasted gently of cinnamon. It made me feel like I was being waved off with a little goodbye kiss. The platform was close by, the barriers up. My seat reservation was at the right end of the train. It was by the window. It faced the right way, with a table, and a plug, and Wi-Fi, which worked. And bang on time, we departed. But then, everything began to unravel. I was only mildly deafened by the scrape of the train as it clung to the ancient rusty rails. As she delivered her spiel, the lady on the PA system sounded only slightly bored, with the merest hint she'd break my arm if I didn't have the right ticket. Just once did my bag spill its contents as the tilt got too much, and because it was a cold day, when I visited the facilities I was almost grateful for the free blast of scorching air in my face when the train lurched so violently it set off the hand dryer. I steadfastly bore the absence of soap. I didn't bother with the buffet car. But so what if the journey shook my bones and exposed me to more bacteria than a tropical disease laboratory? None of the other passengers batted an eye. The train had seats, after all. It left on time. It arrived. Isn't this just how trains in Britain are? This race to the bottom in transport means people's expectations have been ground right down. A friendly cab driver or a tasty breakfast is now an unexpected surprise, and when it comes to what happens on board, well, anything short of a derailment is bliss. Britain's travellers need to realise that perfect is done rather better elsewhere, however, and it didn't seem to hurt them too much getting there. All this week on Monocle 24, we've been exploring global high-speed rail. Here in the United Kingdom, we're having trouble embracing something the rest of the world seems to take for granted, even though the government is planning to link the country now with a new network called HS2. There's predictable protest from the Green Lobby on this matter, and more surprisingly, some would say, from businesses, who argue that shorter journey times are counterproductive, since the modern train is today's mobile office. But what concerns me is that people are now too fixed on this particular project, worrying whether Granny's back garden in Great Missenton will be beggared up by HS2, or if Mr. Whitecollar should hop on Skype instead of boarding a train to see his client in the flesh, is distracting us from the main problem, namely that our entire transport system is quietly rusting away, but nobody says anything about it. At the heart of this problem is a peculiarly British stoicism. We keep smiling, even as we hand over a small fortune for mediocrity or worse. Perhaps if we bucked up our expectations, then the state of our railways would follow suit. All change, please. For Monocle, I'm Emma Nelson.
And that's all we've got time for on today's Midori House. Thank you to our producer, Kate Bilbao, our research team of Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Annabelle Bly, and our two studio managers, Alex Funnell and Toby Hammond. The menu is next, right after the news. The Monocle Daily is here a little bit later, 2200 hours in London. Andrew Muller and Tig Enright are your hosts. But for now, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks very much for listening. Have a great weekend. Goodbye.